Hello everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar, Integration and Automation Using the Azure Data Catalog REST API. Our presenter for today is Matthew Roche, Senior Program Manager at Microsoft. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. Today's presentation will run for about an hour. The webinar is being recorded and will be available on demand within 48 hours. A copy of today's presentation and the recording link will be sent to you via email once the files are available. If you have any questions during the webcast, please enter them in the Q&A widget on the left of your screen and click Submit. We'll try and get through as many questions as we can during the live broadcast. With that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Matthew.
Thank you very much, and good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. My name is Matthew Roche. I'm a program manager on the Azure Data Catalog team here at Microsoft, and I'd like to say thank you for taking time out of your day to learn about the Data Catalog API. I'd like to start off with a quick introduction about me. As I mentioned, I'm a program manager, which means that my primary job responsibility is to help define and implement new capabilities in our service or in the services that we're shipping, and working with our engineering team to actually build them. I don't write much code these days, but I spent probably about 20 years of my life writing code, you know, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week type thing. And as I was leading up to this meeting, I was cleaning out my office. I actually found the first keyboard that I used in my first professional developer's job. I took a picture of it, and I wanted to share it with you guys here. Back when I was writing code for a living, we actually only had zeros and ones, so our keyboards were much simpler than they are these days. I know that you're all laughing wherever it is that you're sitting or standing right now, so just wanted to set the tone for the hour. We are not going to be doing a full overview of Azure Data Catalog as a service. We're going to be talking specifically about the API. If you are new to Azure Data Catalog and have not seen our previous webinar in the series, definitely stay on the call and just understand that a lot of the concepts will make more sense when you have the full context for the service. I will do a quick overview as a refresher and to make sure that everybody has the same basic context, but it will be relatively quick. Essentially, Azure Data Catalog is a service that is designed to enable data source discovery, and it does this by having a metadata repository with a search index that is built on top of that metadata. So essentially, our pattern is to allow users to register data sources into the catalog, where that registration involves extracting some set of metadata from the source, things like the server name or URL, the object name, attribute names, data types, properties, things along those lines, and then submitting them via our API into the service. We also have capabilities for annotation and the crowdsourcing of annotations. So getting the metadata from the data source is great, but if your table name, for example, is ABC123 because the software vendor that built the database was trying to have things that were as short or as obfuscated as possible, it would be nice to have a friendly name or a description or a set of tags to go with the metadata from the source. The catalog is a repository for that type of additional information to make it easier to discover and understand the data source. So using our tools, users can search, they can browse, they can filter, and these capabilities are exposed via our API. The thing that they get back, the thing that the user sees, is the metadata and the annotations that are stored in the catalog. They can then evaluate these to understand the data source and its intent. And once they've done so, they can use the metadata, again, specifically in this case, the location of the information. If you think about it as a connection string, you'll be conceptually on the right path. So they can understand the data and then consume it in their tool of choice. And all of the capabilities that we've built into our experience, we've got a portal for viewing and searching. We've got a data source registration tool for registering. These capabilities are built using the API that we're discussing today. So if you see our tools doing it, you should be able to do that same thing in your application or in your context using our API. This is sort of the one big picture view of the service. Again, the core capabilities that we're driving are allowing people to discover, understand, and consume data. So lots of times you see people that are attempting to do something with data. They're trying to build a dashboard for a self-service BI situation. They're trying to build a data warehouse in a corporate BI situation. They're trying to understand the contents of the company's new data lake for a big data situation. And very often, finding and understanding the data is the biggest challenge. Actually working with the data once you've found it is a simple thing. So we're focusing on discovering, understanding, and consuming. And we enable all of these things through allowing any user of the catalog to contribute metadata so they can tag things, they can document things, they can register new data sources on their own. So we get this whole virtuous cycle of data going on. We've got capabilities, even though we're not going to do more than mention them in passing today, we also have capabilities for the management and curation of the metadata in the catalog. And of course, all of these capabilities are exposed through the API so that we can extend our experiences, you can extend our experiences using our programmatic interface. Now, the title of this scenario talks about integrating and automating. In this context, we see common scenarios for people working with the API, and we'll touch on a lot of the core components and core concepts today. But from a scenarios perspective, we see people who are building data consumption applications, so a tool that will work with data. They're using the Data Catalog API to incorporate data source discovery into their application. So if you have a tool or if you have some application that you've developed where users currently select a server, so let me rephrase that, they don't select a server, they type in a server name, they put in a connection string, they enter a URL where the user needs to know the technical location of the data before they can move forward, that's an opportunity to work on our data source, or to incorporate our data source discovery capabilities into that experience. If you own or work with an application that produces data. So this could be an ETL process. This is probably the simplest scenario. You've built an integration services package or an Azure Data Factory pipeline. You've got some process that is taking data from sources A, B, and C. It's manipulating them and outputting them to destinations X, Y, and Z. To make sure that that work has value, the fact that you now have this new transformed data or the new just copied data, it doesn't necessarily need to be transformed, in this new location, to get more value of that, users need to know where to find it. So as part of that ETL process that is populating the data lake or loading the data warehouse or just copying data from on-prem to or from the cloud, whatever that scenario is, in the same process, you can use our API to register the thing that you're creating, the table, the directory, you know, whatever the data asset is, so that as soon as the data is there, either you have registered it to create a new annotation, if you're creating something new, I'm speaking too quickly today. You can either register it to allow the catalog to be aware that there is a new data asset, or if you're simply putting more data into an existing location, you can then update the annotations of the existing asset in the catalog. So either one of these will be a viable scenario. We also see customers that before Azure Data Catalog had built their own sort of poor man's or ad hoc catalog using Excel, using a SharePoint list, using something along these lines. A common scenario that we see people using the API for is to have a way to extract this existing metadata from the existing source, either to keep the two locations in sync or to have a or to have a mechanism to eliminate the manual data entry or manual re-entry of going from the ad hoc catalog into Azure Data Catalog. And the final common scenario that we see is applications that are presenting data to the users. Again, this is a data consumption application. Using our API, you can pull existing metadata, again, such as tags and descriptions, from the catalog and present it in the context of the tool where you're presenting the data as well, essentially giving a richer and more, more complete data consumption experience. Rather than digging into the REST APIs here, that's going to be the bulk of our talk today, so we won't spend too much time there. The links that are on the slide are to the best places to go to start learning more once this session is done. The first one is a link to our documentation center. We've got a lot of conceptual information. We've got walkthroughs and capabilities and a getting started guide. The second link is to our core developer concepts document. So this is a lot of what we're talking about in this session today. So if you need a refresher, that's the place to go. And the third one is to the actual REST API documentation site on MSDN. So if you're looking for the details, that is the place to go. So let's actually take a look at the API, starting with the core concepts that the API exposes and which make up the application model of Azure Data Catalog as a service. And then let's move on from the concepts into the various operations that we expose. And then we'll dive into some code to actually see these things at work. So first and foremost, Azure Data Catalog relies on Azure Active Directory for its authentication. We have a single catalog per Azure Active Directory. Remember that the value of the catalog, the reason the Azure Data Catalog exists, is to make it easier for people to find and understand and work with data. If it's just you, if it's just one person, you already know where things are, otherwise you wouldn't have been able to register them. So for our production scenarios, having it associated with the corporate Azure Active Directory domain provides a logical boundary for sharing and collaboration. If you are setting up a development or test environment, as you can see I've done here on the screenshot on the slide, I've actually gone into my Azure subscription and created a new Azure Active Directory domain. So it's Azure Data Catalog test.onmicrosoft.com. And in that directory, I have created a user for me to use against the service so I can log in against that directory. And in order for this application to authenticate against Azure Active Directory, we need to create an application for it in directory using the Azure Management Portal. So going through the list here, one, we need to create the directory. Two, we can go into the Applications tab in the directory properties. Three, we can create a new application. Mine is called ADC Test Client. Once that is done, let me click here to build out the slide, we can then go in the client properties, click on the Configure tab. The test client name is basically there to be human readable, but the client ID, which I've obfuscated here, this is the primary property that you as a developer need. You need to copy this client ID and use it in your code to essentially say, this is the application that has been authorized to use Azure Active Directory. For number six, we have a redirect URI. The example that we're looking at here is for a rich client or Windows application where essentially the value that you put in there is not significant because we're not redirecting you back to any page after you authenticate. If you're building a web application, you should take it back to your redirect page. And all the way down there at the bottom, the final thing that you need to do is you need to give explicit permissions for this application to access Azure data catalog. So basically you choose add application and select ADC from the list. We have only one permission set for Azure Data Catalog, at least as of today, so there are not granular permissions that you need to specify here. Now, all of these things are standard for applications that work with Azure Active Directory for authentication, but this is also an area of frequently asked questions from developers working with our API, so I wanted to make sure that that was explicitly outlined up front, because this is sort of the tax or the setup that you need to pay to get started. Now, with that said, we have a set of core concepts, which a lot of them may be obvious or straightforward, but I want to walk through them nonetheless. We've got a catalog, which is the repository itself, so all of the information goes into the catalog. We have one catalog per organization, as I mentioned. We have users, and this is kind of an obvious thing to say, but when we're talking about the permissions for users, the permissions are very context sensitive, and by this I mean for the annotations that a user provides, a user has permissions on their annotations, so that if you tag a data asset, you're the owner of the tag, even if you're not the owner of the asset itself. So the permissions are granular. You have effective permissions on different scales of things. The asset is the unit of manipulation or the core unit of work inside the catalog. A data asset is that set of metadata that represents a real-world data object. So we'll have an asset for a table in the catalog, and it is there as the metadata representation of the actual table and the actual database on an actual server somewhere. Annotations are sets of metadata that describe that that data asset. And beyond that, we've got two different API-specific concepts, specifically views and nested views. When we're using the API, we will need to specify the view that we're working with, and in some operations, we need to specify the nested view. For a view, an example could be tables, it could be reports, it could be KPIs. They reflect on the underlying data types or the underlying root types in our application model. So you can say, I'm working with tables or I'm working with reports to identify the scope of your operations. Similarly, a nested view represents a subset of metadata for a given asset, and this will come into play when you are manipulating a subset of the annotations on an asset. So let's say, for example, you've registered a table and you have added tags to that table. If you want to work with just the tags rather than updating all of the metadata for the asset for the table as a whole, you can use the tags nested view to be very specific about the metadata that you're updating. And again, we'll get into more details as we move through. And even though the final bullet on the slide here isn't at the exact same level as the other concepts, it's worth stressing that the general model that we've implemented is one that says any user can provide metadata for any asset. So if 10 users all find the same table and all 10 of them say, my perspective, the way that I think about this data isn't well represented here, all 10 users can add a description. Each of the 10 users can provide tags if they choose to. Each of the users can identify experts for the asset, and the information that is both supplied to and returned from the API reflects that. And we'll take a look at an example of the JSON that will be returned from one of our API calls as we move forward. So this is the final pretty picture slide before we start looking at the various API operations. This is both a high-level breakdown on the left and a list of the views and nested views on the right. So essentially, we have, for a given catalog, it's associated with an Azure account, and it's associated with an Azure subscription. This is sort of just providing the context for a catalog that's running in the cloud. We can have any number of users, any number of assets, and a given asset can have any number of annotations. We do have some size limits, so if you're thinking about putting many megabytes worth of tags or documentation into the catalog, you may run into some of those limits. Those are documented as part of our developer API, and they, if you do run into those problems, we suggest, let me rephrase that, if you do run into a problem with the limits that are in place, we would love to hear about your scenario via our developer forums on MSDN, which again, we'll show off in a second. So as we're going through the API calls, the operations, just keep these guys in mind that these are the values that we would provide for views and nested views where they are called for in the API. And I guess there's one more thing that I want to throw out here as well. Some of the names, the plurality of the names in the API may often seem strange, where you might have, as you can see down at the bottom of the slide here, it says columns data profile rather than column data profile. We may have descriptions rather than just description. In some cases, that plurality is there to represent the fact that through this multiplicity of opinion and crowdsourcing, that there may be and there is space for multiple instances of a given type of annotation. Some things, such as the friendly name is the example that leads out. This is a singleton. So friendly name and documentation are each singletons where a given asset can have exactly one friendly name and it can have exactly one set of documentation. But for the most part, the other annotations, there can be more than one of them. So I'm going to take a quick sip of water, and then we're going to take a look at the primary operations that our REST API exposes. I should also stress that for most of these operations, the body that's being passed in is a JSON payload, so we're not going to attempt to fit that on a slide. We'll look at that in Visual Studio later on. But here we're looking at the header and the parameters and the HTTP operation that's taking place. So the first thing, the first operation we want to look at is registering a data asset. We're going to use a post call. Notice that this api.azuredatacatalog.com, this is the root of our API for manipulating the contents of the catalog. And we also have a, we have a magic string of default catalog. Every catalog that's created has a name, but you can include a default catalog or the specific catalog name in your call. They will both work. And it's essentially what we're specifying here when we're registering is we're calling the data catalog API. We're passing it into this catalog, and in this example, do you notice how we've got slash views, slash tables, and then the API version, which is always going to be the same, or at least until we version the API. Currently, we have exactly one version of the API that we support, which is the 2016-03-30 General Availability API, but we are specifying here that we are registering a table, and this could be a SQL Server table, it could be an Oracle table, it could be a Teradata table, it's some sort of tabular data. So we are registering a table. This is how the views that we had mentioned earlier on are going to be represented in the API. We also have the ability to annotate a data asset. So picture this as being the catalog already has the table that's been registered, and someone wants to provide a tag or provide an expert or provide a description for it. In this case, we're using a post, We're using the same essential path, so we've got API to AzureDataCatalog.com for all of these operations. We're specifying tables as the view, and in this example, we are specifying experts as the nested view. Now, let me look at a specific scenario where either register, which we just looked at, or annotate, which we're looking at now, could possibly be used. So the primary difference between the two is that register will either create a new asset if no asset exists, or it will update the definition of the asset if the asset already exists in the catalog. And if we double click on this, if we think about this more deeply, think about registering a table in a database. So you call the register data asset call. The catalog is now aware that there is a table with this name, in a schema with this name, in a database with this name, on a server of this name. So we've got the full location of the data asset that's part of the registration. And it's got all of the metadata that was provided, such as the list of columns and their names and their data types, you know, whatever it is that we've extracted from the data source. Now, picture a scenario where the data type of a column changes, or a column is added, or, you know, in a worst case scenario, a column is removed from that table. The way to make the data catalog aware of those changes in the data source is to register that data asset again with the current information. Now, when that happens, what the service does behind the scenes is it will simply update the definition of the catalog, or sorry, update the definition of the asset in the catalog with the new metadata that was supplied, because the register data asset call is a merge or upsert operation. So it's either an update if it's already there, or an insert if it's not. Now, annotate, which we're looking at here, is more of a surgical tool. It's more precise, where we're saying we are making a change to this part of the metadata for this asset. So we're only updating the experts. We're not updating that full definition. And one thing that's worth stressing as well, when we mentioned earlier the multiplicity of opinions or the crowdsourcing of the annotations, a given user can only update his own metadata. So if we have two users, Bob and Susie, if Bob adds a tag, Bob can delete that tag. If Susie adds a tag in a description, only Susie can update or remove those tags and descriptions. The one exception to this is administrators. An administrator can remove another user's asset. Sorry. An administrator can remove another user's annotations, but cannot edit them. The service itself implements the security to make sure that these restrictions are enforced. But one of the things that you'll see in the JSON payload being returned is information about the effective permissions that the current user has on the metadata in the payload, so that you, as a developer of a client experience, can tailor your UI based on what the current user is capable of doing. So we've got the ability to annotate a data asset. We also have the ability to retrieve a data asset by ID. So when you register a data asset, essentially what you're doing is you are passing in the location of the data asset. So again, using SQL Server as an example, it's the four-part name with the server, the schema, sorry, the server, the database, the schema, and the object name, as well as protocol information, basically saying this is a SQL Server database. It's a TDS protocol. And returned from that register call is going to be an ID, a unique ID that the catalog creates to represent the asset on the back end. Now, using that ID, you can call in to get the full metadata, including all annotations for that data asset. So here we're calling into the API with a GET call. We're specifying the table's view, and we're specifying the ID of the table that we're returning. So this is going to get us back a JSON payload with all of the information that we need so that we could build a UI to represent what the catalog knows about that asset. So we also have the ability to update an annotation. So this is similar to annotating, where we will specify the nested view that we're working with. So for update annotation, we are supplying the JSON that represents this part of the documentation for the asset that we've identified. So we're using a put call. We're using the tables view with the ID of the table. In this example, we are using the documentation, or specifying the documentation nested view. If we look at the URI parameters, which I've been deliberately glazing over as we've moved through here, you guys can read the slides as well as I can, but I want to stress that for this nested view, if the nested view represents a non-singleton annotation, which is essentially anything that's not the friendly name or the documentation, you need to specify, for example, which description, which tag, which expert. You're basically saying which one of these things, because the asset may have many of them, are we going to be updating. So in this example up at the top of the slide, because we're specifying documentation which is a singleton view, we haven't specified the ID, but this parameter is required for most of the annotations. And to be completely honest with you, the slide is here because this fits, or documentation is used as the example, because it fits better on the slide, not for any real reason. But again, the key here is that there can be multiple instances of a given annotation on an asset. This call will give us the ability to update a specific instance of a specific annotation type on a specific asset by specifying the IDs for both. And unlike register asset, which supplies all of the all of the metadata for the asset and its annotations in a single operation, this is going to be more granular, more surgical in its nature. We also have the ability to delete annotations. So you guys see here, it's the same essential pattern that we saw for updating annotations, except we're making a delete call rather than a put call. And for this example, I have specified tables for the view and experts for the nested view. So here you can see that when we are working with a non-singleton nested view, as experts are, we need to specify that full ID, which again, you could have gotten back in a call when you were getting the annotation with all of, or getting the asset with all of the annotations that are included. So we also have the ability to delete the asset as a whole. So again, we are making a delete call. We're specifying the view and the ID of the asset in that view. The thing that I want to stress here is that deleting an asset does not have any effect on the underlying data source. This is very obvious when you think about what data catalog is as a service and what it does, but it's also something that anytime that you're saying delete when you're working in an enterprise data scenario, it's worth calling out explicitly. All that delete is doing is removing the metadata from the catalog. It's not affecting the underlying database or table or anything along those lines. So if you are aware that a table or a database no longer exists, this is a way to keep the catalog in sync. And if, to get back to our integration scenario, if you are working on an ETL process, if that ETL process is both creating and manipulating and deleting data sources and objects in those sources, this is something that could well come in. So that, you know, let's say that you have tables that are partitioned by date. So you've got a different table or a different part of your data lake for every month of the year, but you only have the last 36 months that exist in this location. Maybe they're moved off to cold storage, or maybe they have to be deleted for regulatory purposes. You guys have seen these scenarios. Having a delete to clean up those things in the catalog that the ETL process is cleaning up in the real world, that's the path to go down. So we have the ability as well to search, and this may be one of the most frequently used parts of the API. So here we have the ability to pass in both the fact that it is, we're making a call to the search endpoint or the search page. We also have the ability to pass in a variety of parameters to define the search, which includes search terms. We'll look more at this on the next slide. A set of facets, so you can say, I want to facet on tags and data source type and data object type, things along those lines, as well as parameters to control paging. By default, it will return the first page and will have a page size of 10, but you can control paging as well if you want to display more results or if you need to display a page other than the first. For the search syntax itself, we do have a full set of documentation around this, but we have both basic free text search, so you see the examples up here. We give you the ability to scope based on specific properties, so only show me those assets where the term finance appears in the name property rather than in other properties. We support Boolean operators, and, or, and not. You can use parentheses to group them together just exactly as you would expect. For numeric and date data types, we have the ability to use comparison operators, so greater than, less than, greater than and equal to, et cetera, et cetera. Now, let's actually switch contexts here. I want to come into, before we move on to other aspects of the API, I actually want to show some code. We're about two-thirds of the way through the meeting. And before I dive into the code, I want to take a look at some of the questions that are coming in. Apologies to the Microsoft folks on the call who are asking questions. I'm going to prioritize those from external customers up towards the top. So I see a question coming in here. So one catalog per org, how about different environments like Dev, UAT, and Prod? To answer the question, so no, you do not need to have different subscriptions, but at least as of today, you need to have different Azure Active Directory domains. One of the things that we have documentation for, resources online for, are instructions on essentially how to set up a dev or test or demo type environment. One of our MVPs, Melissa Coates, who has a blog under the name of SQL Chick, SQLCHICK, has a great blog post with all of the details there. We are looking at ways to make these different environments simpler to set up and manage, but today it's essentially just a matter of creating a new domain and then having a catalog associated with that domain. So as you can see, I've zoomed in here to my code. I am using this specific domain that I've set up here, Azure Data Catalog Test. It is not unusual to see someone have my company dev.onmicrosoft.com, my company int.onmicrosoft.com, my company UAT, et cetera, and then working in those environments that way. The next, let me unzoom there. Let's see. So how does the tool support integration with ETL tools? Can we document new data created by the ETL tool like calculated fields? How does the tool minimize mistakes caused by manual entry of data to support ETL capabilities? So that's a big multi-part question, which I may not answer fully. But the integration with ETL tools is essentially using our API from within the execution environment of the ETL tools. Every ETL tool that I have used has the ability to put in custom code. It could be the script task in integration services. There's a .NET activity in Azure Data Factory. And because this is a REST API where it's not .NET specific, that's just the examples that I'm using. In that client environment, in the ETL environment where you have the metadata about the thing that is being created, be it a calculated field or other, that's the place for you to construct the JSON payload to submit to the catalog to keep the catalog current and up to date. And for minimizing those mistakes, this is actually a place where our crowdsourcing approach comes in handy, because it is easy for any user to both see the metadata that exists, to understand who submitted that metadata. So this is a description from Bob, but it is not accurate. It's very easy to contact Bob and to ask him to remove it, and to provide additional perspectives as well. So jumping back into the code, moving away from the questions for the time being, I want to stress a couple things. The first one, let me alt-tab over here for a second. The first one is that the code that I am looking at is part of our samples. So this is what we're looking at right here is our documentation center that we included the link for earlier. So we have here a set of samples that are hosted on GitHub that you can download and work with and both explore the API and use as a starting point for your own efforts if you choose to do that. So this is what I am starting with, is essentially the simplest getting started example. I also want to stress, in case I forget to mention it at the end of the call, that our MSDN forums is the best place to go for follow-up questions, so that if there's something that I haven't answered or haven't answered effectively before the end of the call, you can come here to the standard MSDN forum site, search for Azure Data Catalog, or pick us from the list, and engage with me and other members of the team there. So there we go. So let's actually take a look at the code itself. First of all, as I'd mentioned earlier, we need that client ID from Azure Active Directory. So for the purposes of this sample, I've just put it as a string up at the top of my code. Realistically, you'd want it, you know, in a place that's appropriate for your environment. Hard coding strings is not a best practice, but the samples are here to demonstrate concepts rather than best practices. And if we look at the general flow that we're going to go through, we're going to construct JSON to represent a new table that we're registering. So we've got a function that does that. We are going to register that asset in the catalog. We are going to then retrieve that asset, and we'll double click on each one of these guys here. We're going to retrieve this asset based on its ID, and we are then going to search on a different term to see the full scope of things that could be returned from the catalog. So we're going to walk through sort of an end-to-end here. It's definitely touching the tops of the waves, but hopefully it will illustrate as we go through how the concepts and the operations that we've covered in the presentation will come into play here. So let me do this guy. So what I am doing here is essentially walking through the application. And when I come into this register data asset, I have, let me do this. So let me take a look at our JSON visualizer here. So the basic JSON payload that we're passing in is saying it's SQL Server, it's a table, our protocol is TDS, and this is where the table is actually located. So this is the address or the data source location for the object that we are registering. And for the annotations, including the schema, we basically have three different columns where we are saying that we've got an order ID, et cetera, et cetera. So you guys can see what's on here. It's a very, very minimal package that we're passing in just to demonstrate the capabilities. So we have our full URI, which includes the basic path that we were looking at. So we're going against our default catalog, we're going against the table view, and we are passing in this JSON string as our payload. So as we walk through here and step in, so here we're going to set up our request. And at this point, our request, before we pass it to the cloud service, we need to have our authorization token added to the header, our access token. So I'm going to step in here, and here's where you can see the integration with Azure Active Directory coming in. So I'm going to choose this demo account, so I'm connecting to the correct catalog, a super secret password, and so apparently I stepped over instead of stepping into. So I'm going to right click on this access token and choose go to definition. So let's take a look at the details here. We've got our resource URI essentially saying we are connecting to this service. We're connecting to AzureDataCatalog.com. We are using this client ID. This was from Azure Active Directory earlier. We can specify a specific redirect URL here if we choose, but in this case, it's the same one that we've specified in Azure Active Directory. And we're saying this is our authority URI. So basically, we are using OAuth 2 to authenticate against Azure Active Directory. And when we call acquire token, this does the magic of talking with Azure Active Directory, prompting the user, if appropriate, for their credentials, and making sure that that they actually are who they claim to be. So let me scroll back up here to where we were. Come on. Let me do this. The toolbars that I'm used to seeing down at the bottom are hidden by my screen sharing, so I apologize for sort of the old-fashioned navigation here. What we're doing here, as we are setting our request, is we're getting the JSON payload that we had constructed earlier, and we are adding this to the request body. And when we pass this in, we're getting back our response, which if we were to expand it out, we would see that it's OK. We are checking to make sure that we have not been redirected to a different endpoint, in which you can see that the contexts that are in there, or the information that's in the comments. And when it's done, we're going to return that response back to the calling code. Which again is our register data asset helper function. Once this is here, we can get the ID of, let me step over this guy, we can get the ID of the asset that we just registered. So if you notice this, it's a long GUID-laden ID that includes both the GUID, the name of the catalog, as well as the path to the asset in the view that it was registered in. But this is the unique identifier for this asset in this catalog moving forward. So if you want to work with any of the operations that require an ID, this is the ID that we would use. And the next example here is that get data asset by ID. So if I step into this guy, we've got the same essential operation that is taking place before, where we are saying we've got our URI, we've got our get operation, and we're passing in the JSON payload. So if we step, so we're going to get our request and response. We're going to be authorized. We have to go through the authorization process again, but we already have the access token in our context. So once this is done, we can start reading in the response that we're getting back with the metadata for the asset that we're retrieving. And as we step over this guy, you know, sometimes it could be a very large payload, depending on the amount of metadata that's in the catalog. In this case, that is not the case, because we have a very small payload that we provided. We have our string, and if we take a look at this guy in our JSON visualizer, you'll see that the information that we had provided earlier is largely the same. So notice this guy, we still have columns 0, 1, and 2, so we've got the exact same columns that we had provided. But there's a lot of additional context that's included. In addition to the location, so we've got the same data source location with the address and so on that we saw getting passed in, but we also have the ID that was assigned. For the annotations, each one of those is going to have an ID and the timestamp at which that was specified, and we have information about the effective rights that the current user has for this part of the payload, again, so that this can be used in your client experience. Now, what I want to do before I move on to the next bit is I actually want to go into our Azure Data Catalog portal. So this is our primary user experience. And I have pinned on my homepage this orders sample asset that I've just registered. So when I registered it, because it already existed in the catalog, it was doing that upsert operation, so I can pin it and then come back to it later. So here I can see that we've got both the basic metadata, I have the ability to add metadata in the portal, and I have the information about the columns down here as well, so pretty bare bones, just the three columns. If I come back to the home page, I'm going to click on this transaction history table. So this is a table that is much more robustly annotated. So a preview has been supplied. There's more columns, and there is more metadata for those columns. So notice that for the transaction ID column, there are descriptions both from me as the current user and from the data source as well. And over here on the right, you can see that experts have been specified as well as tags. So this is a lot more metadata. It's a much more complete much more complete asset in the catalog, and this is what I'm going to be searching for in the next example. So here I am going to, let me F10 and F10, so we set our search string. I am going to come in here, build up my URI where I am specifying the term that was being passed in. We're going to call our get method. We're going to take the results, we're going to stream them back and pass them back up to the calling code, and again, and again, and I have a breakpoint when we're when we're adding the header, which is why it keeps stopping there. So we'll step back up, and once we have done this, I'm going to take the contents of the JSON payload, because as you can probably imagine, this is not going to be super easy to explore in our JSON visualizer. It's kind of large. So I've taken it and I've dumped it out to a text file. And when I come over here, I can see the text file. Let me pretty format this here in Visual Studio. And you can see that we have both the information about the thing that was being searched for. If I scroll down to the bottom here, I can see that there is metadata about highlighting. So I'm actually going to show this off in the portal real quick here. So I'm going to search for, let me clear the existing search. I'm going to search for transaction history. And if I select this asset, do you notice how the name and some of the descriptions, both at the table level and at the column level, are highlighted in our portal UI? The way that we do this is by parsing this part of the JSON essentially to say that these are these are the properties of these assets that were used to respond to the search. This is why you're getting back this asset from the search. And with this full payload, we could display something as complete as what is done in the Azure Data Catalog portal, or we could have something that is much more targeted depending on your needs. But the basic pattern, and I'm going to move back here to the slides away from Visual Studio. The essential pattern is that it's all RESTful HTTP, JSON payloads being passed back and forth. There's both registration and annotation to either create or manipulate the contents of the catalog, and we have the ability both to search through the contents if we don't know the ID. This is what will drive lots of user experiences, as well as to get annotations by ID, which is something that will be how we would programmatically identify and manipulate a specific asset. So, beyond this core API that we've focused on, we have two additional APIs that are siblings to the core API. One of them is an API for managing our business glossary. So the business glossary is essentially a set of predefined standardized terms and hierarchies of terms within the catalog that can be used for tagging and navigating through the catalog contents in a standardized way that maps to your business needs. And we also have a catalog management API, which is essentially the standard Azure Resource Manager API just for our Azure Data Catalog service. So if you want to programmatically create a new catalog or things along those lines, or delete a catalog, this is the API to use. The Business Glossary API uses a very common pattern to what we talked about today. The Catalog Management API uses the same pattern that Azure Resource Manager uses, so a little bit different than most of what we looked at. So from a next steps perspective, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through the open questions that are in our Q&A pane after we have wound down the presentation itself. If I do not have an answer for you today, before the meeting is done, there's sadly we don't have the capability to capture every meeting or to respond after the meeting is shut down, or to capture every question or respond after the meeting is shut down. So if you do have a question that I don't get a chance to answer in the meeting, please head over to our forums on MSDN, and either I or another member of the catalog team will do our best to get you an answer as soon as possible. And beyond that, we're very interested to know what you think of both the service and the webcast. And with that note, I am exactly at time, so I'm going to hand this back over for the event organizers to wrap things up. Thank you again very much for your time.
Thanks, Matthew, for the great presentation. You should see a screen with poll questions for feedback. If you have a moment, please leave any feedback that you have. It really helps us to make these webinars more effective. And next one. And just as a reminder, we will be sending out the slides and the recording for everyone shortly. You should be expecting to get it in the next day or so. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. Have a great day.